Hello and welcome to the final Mirror Mall podcast of this Guinness Six Nations Championship and to the episode where we say, we told you so. Wales are Grand Slam champions and Scotland rightly rather pleased with themselves, which leaves Ireland and England wondering, what the hell happened there? My name is Alex Spink, rugby correspondent of the Daily Mirror, and as ever, I'm joined by Paul Grayson, World Cup winner and Mirror columnist, Neil Squires, correspondent of the Daily Express, Michael Scully, correspondent for the Irish Mirror, and live from Cloud 9, Wales Online's Andy Howell. Let's start with a quick reminder of what we thought at the time bookmakers had Ireland and England at 1 and 2 in the Six Nations betting.
Who's going to win the 2019 championship?
I think you could probably perm any 5 from the 6. I would probably boil it down to Wales, Ireland or England. And I like Wales' chances. A lot of focus on Ireland, England. But I think Warren Gatland is right that if Wales win in Paris on the opening weekend, on the Friday, and that is a big if, of course, but if they do that, the fixtures fall very nicely for them. A couple of away games, and then they have England and Ireland at home. Wales are 1-9 on the spin. They'll be confident. No one's talking about them, but they're world ranked 3. So
they are now world ranked 2, sitting on a national record 14 consecutive wins. Proud and deserved winners of a third Grand Slam in 11 years. And, according to boss Warren Gatland, live contenders for the World Cup. Andy Howell, our man in the Principality, what's your take on that?
They're certainly contenders after winning the Six Nations. You know, I think they were the best team in the tournament, so they deserve victory. Yes, they're in with a chance of World Cup. I don't think you can read too much into the Six Nations. I think England are going to be a force of the World Cup. It's going to be interesting to see which way Ireland go. And, you know, the All Blacks are still going to be the favourites. And, you know, I think South Africa as well will pose a threat. So, yeah, I think Wales are in a group of teams that can win the World Cup. And as we saw in the Six Nations, they tend to get better as tournaments go along. My other concern would be Wales, their try count wasn't very good. It was down with Italy, who finished bottom of the tournament. So they've won the Six Nations on defence. And I think come the World Cup, there'll be an instance in at least one game where they would have to score tries to win it. Now, that's my only sort of fear. If Wales are forced to, we're chasing a game like Ireland were at the weekend, would Wales be able to pull it out of the bag?
Wales have been listed for the World Cup in the betting behind both England and Ireland, despite winning the Grand Slam, which kind of echoes back to the start of the Six Nations, where again they were behind those two. Talking to Toby Faletau about this for a piece in the Mirror, and he said that, you know, people doubted us, and that just added to what was already a driven team. Well, he said going in we had won 9 in a row, yet we went in under the radar, and clearly he felt that that kind of gave them added fuel to the fire. Are you surprised that this Welsh team hasn't had more respect from other people?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's ridiculous where they are in the betting. Yeah, they should certainly be ahead of Ireland. I suspect it is to do with the fact that England and Ireland are bigger betting markets, so they're shorter prices. Not so many people live in Wales, but you know that the Welsh players now must be thinking, well, you know, we've just won a Six Nations. We've won a record 14 in a row. And people still think that Ireland and England are better than us. Is it just ignorance of Welsh rugby? It could be something as simple as that. Mm. You know, if anything, I think it's disrespectful. And I'm really surprised because Wales have, you know, proven over the last 13 months what a good side they are and an improving team.
OK, we're about to pack the Six Nations away in a box and put it in the memory banks. Let's get a few thoughts that you're going to be packing away at the end of this championship, Andy, the end of this third Gatland Grand Slam. A star of the championship for you?
Alan Wynne-Jones, without a shadow of a doubt. I think he's not only has he been an inspiration for Wales. What's really interested me the last few years, followed his whole career, is Alan Wynne-Jones. He's 33 now, but since 2016, he's really developed his game. They've slimmed him down. He's more mobile than ever, and he's worked so hard on his handling skills and his ball carrying. You know, he's a much better player now than he was 4 or 5 years ago, when he was a really good player then. And it just shows, you know, every day Alan Wyn-Jones, he thinks he can improve. I think he should be a Six Nations player of the tournament, because he's covered every blade of grass in the matches. So yeah, I think he's been absolutely outstanding and deserves plaudits.
If there's just one memory you can take away from the championship, what would it be?
It'd be Josh Adams' try against England.
Yep.
The cross kick from Bigger, and Adams outjumped Elliot Daly. Sheer determination, he wanted it so much, and he juggled the ball, still managed to catch and score the try, because then that gave Wales enough of a buffer to ensure they would win that match. So I think that was a key moment.
Best match of the championship. Now, England-Wales was a bumper one, wasn't it? And then all of a sudden, England-Scotland came along the other day, which was rather incredible. What would be your pick?
I think England, Scotland, actually, yeah. Because England 31 points up, made loads of changes. Probably thought the job was done. I guess players perhaps were starting to look ahead to the following week. Scotland threw caution to the wind, and they came back, and perhaps they should have won it in the end. It reminded me of Wales. Wales' big comeback against New Zealand at the 2003 World Cup. The match, I can't remember the score, was 40 or something to the All Blacks. But, Wales in that match, the same, threw caution in the wind. And do you know what? A lot of Wales' successes since have come on the back of that match.
Mm.
So maybe that with Scotland's second half performance will give them hope and inspiration for the future.
If it was the biggest disappointment of this championship for you, what would it be?
Ireland. I thought that I cannot believe how much they were hurt by the defeat to England. There wasn't that much in that game, really. It was a lot of fine margins, but I don't think they've recovered from it. It's knocked the stuffing out of them. And if Irish fans feel like before the Six Nations, they were talking up Ireland are going to win the World Cup. Well, I fear for Ireland that they could have their usual fate at the World Cup, where they don't tend to get past the quarterfinals. It could be, and I think it's the World Cup's a wrong time for some of their players who are getting a bit perhaps long in the tooth. And I'm talking about big hitters here, Sexton, Sean O'Brien, and I don't think Conor Murray's in the same place since he had a serious neck injury.
We'll get a verdict on Ireland's title defence from Mick Scully, correspondent of the Irish Mirror, shortly. But first to England, 31-0 up on Scotland after 29 minutes, 38-31 down after 77. Level pegging at full time. Paul Grayson, a quite remarkable evening at Twickenham.
England were just blisteringly good in that opening 25 minutes. Faultless, ripped Scotland apart. Didn't even, it looked like men against boys, and there's part of your soul that sort of started to ebb away a little bit. It's like the tournament cannot finish with Scotland getting roundly thrashed by England at Twickenham. That's, well, certainly wasn't what I wanted, because you expected so much of Scotland going into the tournament, and notwithstanding all their injuries, they really hadn't produced anything of note. And then, almost as bizarre as it is to say that a hooker will charge down a kick 55 metres from the try line and outpace the fastest guy in the tournament and the England captain to score under the post, as ridiculous as that was paled into insignificance compared to what happened over the next 50 minutes, which was just astonishing.
Yeah. I mean, it's without precedent, really, isn't it? I can't think of anything to even compare with it.
No, and you try and think about different ways to look at it, and you get in the moment, you're into the stats. When would England have conceded 38 unanswered points? And my guess was when they lost 76-0 to Australia on the tour of hell.
Yeah.
Ironically, the cumulative score of the draw in the end. It was just one of those, it was just a bizarre day.
Mm.
And as good as England were and made Scotland looking incredibly poor in the first half, flipped the game on its head, and Scotland exposed England over and over again to the tune of 38 points, which every time I say it seems more and more strange. And then actually the very end of the game, and it's almost lost in the fact that it was such a remarkable encounter. Eddie Jones took off Owen Farrell, took off his talisman and captain, replaced him with George Ford, made him captain, and somehow George Ford managed to engineer a number clock in the red 7-pointer under the post to maintain that haven't lost to Scotland since 1983 record, which has kind of almost gone by the wayside, such was the nature of the game.
When you see the comment after the game, Eddie Jones talking about England's kind of mental frailty, if you like, not able to kind of manage the momentum shifts and get their head around all of that. And really, I think Owen Farrell taking some of the stick for that as captain. How do you appraise that? Is he making excuses? Is the merit in what he's saying? I was a bit uncomfortable with it, frankly, especially when he says we haven't really sorted these problems since the 2015 World Cup. So he was kind of bringing that regime into the here and now as well.
Well, whenever you say something in the media, you have to expect it to be scrutinised, and people can take things in different ways. And you know, I was involved in live broadcast post match, listened to Eddie's interview live, and the only thing I picked out of it was he made a comment about players on the pitch perhaps not taking information on board, or not accepting the messages that come onto the field, or not maybe acting on those. But I just flagged that up at the time and said, well, that's the only thing I can think of, which is it's a strange thing to say. Broadcast colleague immediately, who has great journalistic instincts, immediately jumped on it and said, so you're saying nothing's changed since 2015? Mm. You know, I had to row back a bit because I wasn't saying that. I was just saying the only thing I can pick out of what he said is perhaps the communication from off the side of the pitch onto the pitch isn't as good as it should be, which is just a strange thing to pick up on in that moment, because realistically, England should have just given Scotland the credit they deserve for playing. That's one of the best, most creative halves of rugby you'll see from a fly-off. I thought Finn Russell was just sensational in the second half, picked England apart with every pass in the book, and they rode that momentum all the way to 38-31. But I think Eddie's problem, or one of them, is that when England perform really well, the messages go high, and when England perform badly, the messages go really low. And I think that is reflected in the two games that they've one loss and one draw. You know, you don't get carried away with the victories, and you don't get carried away with the losses. You don't turn into a bad team overnight because you've had a poor performance. So I think some of the that if messages are inconsistent, or if they veer too far away from what is your stated mission, then you're always going to get a little bit of pushback from the media, and I think that's entirely right.
I'm concerned that he should label this group of England players kind of mentally frail, if you like, because yes, there have been four games in which England have given up big scores over the last 9 months or so, but the first two of those, as I wrote in a piece in the Mirror, for me were more down to the altitude of South Africa than the attitude of the players. And yes, it has since then, there have been a couple of occasions, but nonetheless, is it not a dangerous 6 months out from the World Cup to kind of put that one on the players? Even if you believe it, you might want to keep it in-house, but do you want to say it publicly?
Yeah, I 100% agree. And if, you know, the one thing you might level at the players is, you could almost say England were victims of their own excellence. They were so good in that opening period that, unfortunately, mentally, everybody turned the tap off at the same time. Mm. And it's a good learn for us. We need to be relentlessly excellent like the Kiwis are. And you've got your message out there, you've pushed it away, people will nod their heads and say, yeah, that's right, and you can, you know, smack on the wrist for collectively assuming that the next 50 minutes Scotland are just going to let you carry on doing what you want. And that's the beauty of international sport. You know, it happened in a different way against Wales, but that, to me, that's a much better way of managing your message, because you accept, you know, and the players would happily accept that, I'm sure, that England did switch off, because they were sublime for that opening period, and that would have been the end of that, but it's almost you starting your own fires, which is just daft.
Yeah, you made some interesting observations afterwards on Five Live about Owen Farrell as captain. We all know that there are not too many test captains at fly half in international rugby, and maybe Saturday was a good example as to why that is. You felt, just to put the words back to you, you felt that basically he's got too much on his plate.
And that's part of that is experience from wearing the number 10 shirt and captaining a handful of games myself, not in an England shirt, but in a Northampton shirt, although I did captain England for about half a game once. And you're supposed to be the tactical guiding light for your side, you and the scrum half, and obviously there's a couple of players in there who would have input, but the going all the way back to Martin Johnson, one of Martin Johnson's great strengths as a captain was his ability to delegate at the right time, and very often when things weren't going well, and he would furrow his brow and get out that commanding index finger and say, it's your job to tell us what to do next, effectively. And once you've given us that message, I will make sure that everybody else is 100% behind it. So you get to be, you're empowered to make the tactical decision, and then the team get on board with that. Owen finds himself in a position where he's pointing that index finger at himself, you know, and saying, right, what are we going to do? And the feeling for me is, without Dylan Hartley around, because there's no doubt that Dylan adds something to that pool of leadership that England have got, not necessarily from a starting position, but certainly, you know, when you're in a firestorm of a game like that and it's not going well, if you've got 100 cap or almost 100 cap experienced captain on the bench, who is still more than capable of playing international rugby, there's a good use of leadership for me. I just think a fly half's job is so detailed and full, and you're the goal kicker, and there is not a second in the game where you're not in it. When everyone else is having a breather, you're kicking the goal, or you're kicking to touch, or you're calling the shots. You know, it is absolutely difficult to then be able to be the emotional barometer of the team as well. I just think it's an extraordinarily hard job, and he would shrug his shoulders and say, I'm fine with it, no problem, and that's great. That's the sort of bloke he is, and he will take more and more and more responsibility. But at some point, as a coach, you've got to work out whether that is the best management of the playing resources and the intellectual and emotional capital you've got within your team. And from personal experience and from what I see, I think it's almost too difficult a job on his own.
The problem is, we're 6 months away from a World Cup. There are no competitive matches left before the World Cup. If there's going to be a change, it needs to be made pretty sharpish.
Yeah, and I go back to what I just touched on a moment ago. I think Dylan Hartley has a big play in this going forward. I think Maro Itoje has a big play in this going forward. I think there's a rebalance, and I don't think it's a massive one at all. I've been, England's best bits out of this Six Nations are as good as anybody's across the world. Their couple of mistakes have been where the game gets slightly out of control, completely different circumstances in Wales and at Twickenham. I don't think that there is a huge shift. I just think there needs to be. We all scoffed a little bit at the job share. No, not scoff, that's not the right word, but co-captains always you know, slightly something jarring about it.
Yeah.
Is Hartley worth a place, etc., etc.? Well, you know, you might end up with three. You might end up with Farrell, Itoje and Hartley playing different roles. And I think, again, it's easy to look back and compare, but England never won a Grand Slam without Johnson, Dallaglio and Dawson in the team. They lost games when one of those three wasn't in. Obviously, clearly Martin was the captain, but the other two England captains in the side who'd done it for extended periods were Dawson and Dallaglio. And that was the balance that ultimately took them to the World Cup. They didn't have the name of a co-captain, but they pretty much were. And I don't see anything wrong with having that blend, whether you have to make it obvious and explicit and put a label on it or not. But I think England have got the right balance of players within their squads to fulfil those roles, and it shouldn't just be Owen Farrell shoved out the front to do everything.
Okay, so looking ahead to the World Cup now, coming out of this Six Nations, you seem pretty positive about England, despite the near nightmare of a 38-31 defeat to Scotland that we all came so close to seeing. It's not all doom and gloom as far as you're concerned for England.
Well, it can't be. I know they're. First round victory against Ireland, which is a game that they've been preparing for sort of psychologically for, didn't suggest that Ireland would be that poor for the rest of the tournament, but it certainly put a massive hole in their confidence and rocked them. You know, who knew France would be quite so giving when they came to Twickenham? And for 50 minutes against Wales, England were everything you wanted them to be. So I'm not, from a rugby point of view, I'm not concerned about England, because the very best of their performance is a match for everybody else. The one thing that they're going to have to get right is when things aren't going their way, what are their strategies to deal with it? What are their strategies to ride those moments when momentum's gone the other way? What are the tactical shifts that they can go to so they don't end up caught in a cycle of chasing a game that doesn't need to be chased, or allowing a team to get a foothold in a game where they are comfortably in control. And as much, a fair amount of that can be done in your war room as it can on the field. And I know it's not perfect going into, you know, games from here on in are warm-up games and maybe a couple of games to expose players who might be on the fringes of making the squad. My hope for England is that if they can get anywhere near their best performance levels, make a couple of leadership decisions and tactical decisions. I'm not in the camp of we've absolutely lost the plot, because fully fit, everybody playing and at it, England will be a handful for anyone.
And you don't think there is a mental frailty there which will always show itself in the biggest games?
I think the only opportunity they've got, obviously, to answer that is by getting into the biggest games. Mm. But at some point, yes, you are led by your coach, but there is a point where, in any team, where the balance of not who's in control, but it's a shared ownership between the coaches, your head coach and your senior players. Whether England have got that balance right at the moment, I don't know. But add up all their highlights, find out what went wrong in those bits where they did get it wrong. It's mental more than physical. Well, part of that work can be done off the field. So I don't think you can write England off at all. You can be frustrated as a fan that things went wrong. Had England lost at the weekend and not found a way out of that hole, the noise would be a whole lot worse. But ultimately, haven't got themselves in a massive pickle. They found a way out of it, which was a bold coaching decision and some excellent play ultimately to salvage a draw. So I can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. England have done enough good things to suggest that if they can mentally make a little bit of a shift, they won't be a million miles away.
Okay, good enough. Enough of England. Wales won the title, third Grand Slam in 11 years for Warren Gatland. They go forward now to the World Cup 8-1. Pretty good price, I would have.
Yeah.
I would say. What chances do they have going forward, and how sizable achievement was that by them?
I think it's a brilliant achievement. You look at half time in Paris on the opening night of the tournament, you'd have got better odds than 8-1 on them lifting the World Cup. I think an absolute victory for an experienced, confident, intelligent coach and coaching team. Listening to Gatland before and after winning the Grand Slam, he was constantly just pushing the message that to give his team confidence and belief, and he knows he's got a good team and got some great players. I think in those, in the even just in towards the last game when Ireland made the decision to keep the roof open, which turned out to be probably an average decision from their point of view, whichever way they'd gone, you know that Wales, that Gatland would have been able to inject energy into his team because of that decision, just to give them 1% more. If Ireland had said keep the roof closed, well, they think they can outplay you. Ireland have left the, you know, left the roof open. They think the weather's going to help them. He's a master at just filling his team up to the sort of emotional pinnacle that they were at for that game on Saturday, which they just dominated start to finish. So he knew the England game was the one. He built up to it perfectly once they got that win. Well, he talked about momentum. Didn't they have that?
Yeah, they scored the fewest tries in the championship alongside Italy. Their defence clearly was awesome. Is that going to be a problem going to the World Cup, or defences win championships? The old mantra is, will that be good enough?
Yeah, absolutely. And it is tournament play, knockout rugby, must win. There's a couple of ways you can go about it, but if you can keep the opposition to a limited number of points and then take your opportunities, you're a tough team to beat, as they've proved, because they know they've got firepower, but they seem to be able to ration that, and the game has moved to a point where they can control their risk in attack but match it with brilliantly organised defence and some absolute heroic defence. And whatever they're doing in terms of conditioning, the deeper they get into games, I know the crowd helped them on Saturday, but the deeper they get into games, you saw it against England, they seem to be able to find a little extra pot of energy when they need it. So they've absolutely deserved to be where they are, number two in the world, because of the games that they've won. They've not always played superbly well, but it has been creditable and good to watch too, because, you know, they're a team full of people you like. I do a bit of work with Dan Bigger, and you know, he's played a significant role for Wales in this tournament. How can you not like Alan Wynne-Jones? And there's some good humour come out of their camp, and to see an entire country respond to their Grand Slam win, A, to get behind them, and B, to respond to it. Some of the video and pictures of the singing and the gatherings that they've got, it's fantastic for Wales, and it's a brilliant, anybody with just half an interest in the game see how much it means to people to win the Grand Slam. It's extraordinary, really.
They're in Pool D at the World Cup with Australia and Fiji, amongst others. That's a tough pool, potentially a quarter final against England. Is this a Wales team that can win the World Cup?
It can get as close as the last one that got to a semi-final.
Yep.
2011. And then you're in the lap of the gods, because they should have won that one, but Sam Warburton taking an early bath, that could have been a World Cup final, and then who knows. So yes, everybody fit, they're good for their place in the world, and therefore good for a place in the semis should they get things right.
England's first engagement at the World Cup is against Tonga on the 22nd of September. Down the road in Yokohama, that day Ireland plays Scotland. All of a sudden, that is a huge match, isn't it? An absolutely huge match, given the way that those two teams have come out of the Six Nations.
Well, and it's funny, isn't it? Because Scotland, bar their phenomenal comeback or the rally at Twickenham, you would have said that their Six Nations has been pretty disastrous, wouldn't you?
Plenty of hype,
lots of injuries, that's understandable. But some of the performance levels, as we said before, despite the fact that they've got a lot of players out, too much of it has looked a bit like the first half against England, where you're looking for kind of that Scottish mentality of hit and run, play fast, move the ball, brave and daring and taking risks and you know, without stereotyping, mounting raids here and there. And they just didn't do any of that. But then from nowhere against England, they found all of it. And they've found enough ball to give undoubtedly the most creative fly half in the Northern Hemisphere the opportunity to open his box of tricks and create for them. So it's a weird dynamic that they'll come out of the Six Nations feeling slightly annoyed they didn't win at Twickenham, but actually not too bad off the back of quite a lot of mediocre stuff, whereas Ireland just seem like they're punched out in this tournament, like they've gone to the well so often in 2018 to get the performance levels that they got and to win the games that they got. As soon as England let them have it in round one, almost like they just, you know, too much air had gone out of their balloon, they couldn't really recover. It'd be interesting to see actually how they bounce back going towards the World Cup, because it's been quite a stunning change, really.
Okay, let's just go around our various correspondents who have contributed to the pod to get their thoughts on how the Six Nations Championship finished. Let's start with Express correspondent Neil Squires. Squarsy?
I think, you know, overall, it was a fair outcome. Wales were the most consistent side over the course of the Championship. Did it when it mattered against England, and in the final game against Ireland, they saved their best till last. England were hot and cold. When they were hot, they were really good. When they were cold, they were pretty bad. So I think it was a fair outcome. Ireland just went missing. So those were the three who could have won it. And well done, Wales.
Yeah, Wales didn't really put a foot out of place, did they? Either figuratively or literally in this championship. They said all the right things. And when they did make claims, they then delivered upon it, which is something which England did not do.
Yeah, well, Warren Gatland was pretty bold at the start in calling it. You know, if winning France, they win the title. But he put the pressure on the team there. I think possibly there was a little bit of a World Cup warm-up there. They delivered for him. They didn't play their best rugby when he changed the side for the second game out in Italy. But when it came to the England game, you know, they were immense in that physical battle. And they turned it around from a difficult half-time deficit. From there on in, I expected them to close it out, and they did so in some style against Ireland.
Your star of the championship would be who?
Well, I think pretty much everyone has to say it's Alan Wynne-Jones, don't they? He was the captain of the winning team. He was a colossus on the field. He was a spiritual leader of that side. And he's just a war horse, isn't he? Game after game, he delivers for that side. And he's so important to Wales going forward. They've somehow got to wrap him in cotton wool and make sure he's in one piece for that World Cup, as he would leave a huge hole if he was missing.
Best match of the championship?
Well, I think it had to be the England-Scotland game at the end. It was certainly the craziest match. It was, I don't think I've ever seen a game like that. It was just ludicrous. From England's 31-0 lead to Scotland leading 38-31 with the clock red, and then England pulling out of the fire at the end. What a game.
Are England in better shape at the end of the championship than they were at the start, or was the jury out on that?
I think they are in the type of rugby they're playing. The attacking rugby is certainly moved on several gears. I think Scott Wisemantle is doing a good job there with the type of rugby they're playing. But the problem possibly is between the ears. They seem to have their moments when they're just shut down, and when things turn the wrong way, they don't seem to be able to react. you know, there's so much potential there in that side. There's a lot of talent, a lot of power, and they've got some big players to come back as well, with Mako Vunipola, Mauro Toji, Anthony Watson. People have forgotten about him, a really successful Lion. You know, and there's Big Joe as well to come into that picture too. It's an awful lot of talent in that side, but it's a question of whether they'll be able to find the consistency when it's needed at a World Cup.
When you look back on this championship, what memory will spring to mind above all others?
I think as the Wales-England game was ticking down to the final whistle, just that swelling realisation around the Principality Stadium that Wales were going to win that game and beat the old foe. That really was quite a noise inside that stadium at that moment, and you really understood in those closing minutes, you know, what it meant, what rugby meant in Wales, and also what beating England meant as much as anything.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And I mean, covering England, if I was to ask you for your biggest disappointment, would it come from an English perspective, or would you slightly look further afield?
I think my biggest disappointment actually was that we didn't get to see more of Stuart Hogg. Actually, he's such a great player to watch, but he was invalided out of the tournament in the Ireland game. You know, Scotland, that was the story of Scotland's championship, really. So many injuries in that side. I mean, there was a remarkable effort that they pulled a draw out at Twickenham in the final game. I'd have loved to have seen more of him. There were too many absentees at top level to start with, and the loss of him was a blow to the championship as well as Scotland, I think.
6 months out from the World Cup, if you had to put your last pound coin on a team to win it, who would you fancy at this stage?
Well, I wouldn't win much with my bet, but I would still go with New Zealand. I think Wales have shown that they're now a side that can threaten, but they need to find something else, I think, with their attack to really be viewed as a contender at the World Cup. You know, 10 tries in 5 games. The attack doesn't quite match the defence. I mean, they can go to Japan with confidence, but I still think New Zealand have a few more shots in the locker. I'd still go with them.
Yeah, Wales scored the same number of tries as Italy in this championship, so that tells you something. But you know, it's not about that, is it? They only conceded 7, which was by far the fewest. And I guess at the end of the day, championships are won by defences more often than not.
So they say, and that has tended to be the case. But I still think they just need a little bit more to their game. And I think they've still got time. They're going to have a lot of time together over the summer. They've got warm-up games as well. You know, I think they can still come on. I mean, Gareth Anscombe's fairly new to that role as the primary playmaker before Bigger comes on. So I think, you know, there's a possibility Reece Webb might be back in the picture by then as well. There's a few more attacking options that are coming over the hill. Maybe Faletau fit as well. So, you know, I think there is room for them to take it up another notch even.
There's certainly room for Ireland to raise their game. Grand Slam winners a year ago, third this time. I can't imagine, Mick Scully, there are too many smiles inside or outside the camp.
The mood is pretty sombre, and there's an awful lot of questions being asked right now. Even of the coach, who was pretty much untouchable, you would say. The best coach Ireland have ever had, and there's a lot of questions today about whether the team are playing for him at this stage, even, you know. Whether his tactics have been worked out by other teams, whether some of his old regulars are just not up to it now, and suddenly there's so many questions. When before the championship, it was all looking so positive ahead of the World Cup.
Everyone thought that the Irish system was the panacea of all ills, wasn't it? You know, the way you look after the players, the way, etc., etc. It just shows everything is so much more complicated, so much more complex. It's not just one simple solution to everything, is it?
Absolutely, and you know, we forget that Ireland have only won the Grand Slam three times since 1948. You know, so it's just an amazing competition, the Six Nations and Five Nations before it. Anything can happen, as we saw on the final day, in Twickenham in particular, and at the Principality, where, you know, we all expected a real ding-dong classic, and Wales to really have to fight for that Grand Slam. And in the end, it was a procession. So it was a pretty amazing end to the championship, and not one that we expected at all.
Did you think, or do you think, that the timing of the announcement that Joe was going and Andy Farrell was taking over, you can look at it two ways. One, a bit like Wales, they've managed it well, yeah, made it nice and clear, nice and transparent, everyone moved on. But there's always a sense slightly, and a concern slightly, that when you do make an announcement like that, you wonder whether players slightly lose their focus, not quite sure who the boss is. Is there any relevance in any of that?
You know, when he said it and we reflected on it, and you kind of go, okay, what is going to happen here? And then we saw what happened with the opening game against England. You kind of go, is this a factor? But then, as you said, you look at Wales, they, you know, the players still played for Warren Gatland. So the fact is, even more so, you know, Ireland's own successor is in the camp already, in Andy Farrell. And, you know, if they're not playing for the current coach, they'd be playing for the coach that's there, that's going to be succeeding him, who's right there watching everything going on. Also, this is a World Cup year. They only come around once every 4 years for a lot of players. This will be their one and only chance to really, really shine on the world stage in the competition. You know, Ireland has historically done so badly in the World Cup that finally this was seen as the real chance to change that. Again, but, you know, there's so much for players to play for. So, you know, that theory, it shouldn't really wash. It has been suggested in a couple of papers that perhaps Joe himself is tired, and maybe this is a part of the reason why he wants to take a break, that... He's been at this level for so long. He's a coach that's known for painstaking detail and research, and so impressive to listen to in terms of, you know, his knowledge of players, his own players and opposition players and opposition teams. Perhaps it does wear you out. So I think what Ireland need to do now is they need to hope their top players go away, have really good finishes to the season with the provinces. We've got Leinster versus Ulster coming up in the Champions Cup quarter final in a couple of weeks. Munster in action again, also in the last eight. We need big performances from guys like Johnny Sexton, Conor Murray, Sean O'Brien. All these guys need to really start playing again, and then go away, have a bit of a break over the holidays, come back refreshed. You know, as Brian O'Driscoll said today, he doesn't think it's crisis stage yet. He does think that with some tinkering, a bit of change, especially Ireland's kicking game does seem to be worked out, and they're going to have to go away and repair that. He thinks that they can go back strongly. We'll wait and see. But not in a good place now, and down to third in the world as well. Yeah. So plenty to ponder and to reflect on in the coming weeks for Joe Schmidt.
I've asked our other colleagues for their biggest disappointment, and almost to a man, they've said Ireland in this championship, which I guess you'd say the same. It's hard to argue with that. So if we take that as read, just looking broadly across the championship, your star of the championship, who's been the star man for you, player or coach?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you look at how long Alan Wynne-Jones has been there, he's the sole survivor from the 2008 Grand Slam. He's won three of them along with Warren, and he's still a colossus. He's unbelievable. What, 33 now, I think. He's just like an old soldier. He went down injured early on in the game, seemed to twist his knee on Saturday, and he played on regardless, and I think he just epitomises the whole effort there, you know. And you think about, he was a guy that I don't think Gatland fully trusted earlier in his career, and in fact it was only under Rob Howley that he was kind of made permanent captain when Warren went away with the Lions, took a sabbatical with the Lions, and he's just become one of Wales's greatest ever leaders and players. He's been the hero. Also, the icing on the cake was him giving his training top to the the shivering and wet mascot as they lined up for the anthem, so it just kind of summed up the whole heroic effort. Pretty much a Superman, really, isn't he? Welsh rugby.
Didn't it just... when you look at the best match, the best memory of the championship, what would you pick out
for? I think it's got to be the last one, doesn't it? What a second half that was at Twickenham. It was just bonkers. How England could throw away a 31-0 lead. I know since sitting in the press area after the Wales Ireland match, I think the Welsh reporters were nearly getting more excited at the Scottish comeback. You'll be pretty surprised to hear, Alex.
Let it go.
that was sensational, and for Eddie Jones to come out afterwards and say that his team needs a sports psychologist, I think just made it worse personally.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
not a good sign.
So when Alan Jones, the hero, the villain of the piece in this championship, can you pick someone else? Pick someone out you were disappointed in?
I could name any number of Irish players, and certainly you've got to look at World Player of the Year, Johnny Sexton, who just had an awful day on Saturday. Just nothing went right. And he'll have to go away and reflect on that too. I think, kind of coming from left field, it was a bit sad for Italy to... Italy nearly got the win that they so desperately wanted there on Saturday as well against France. But Damien Penno came up with a brilliant tackle to stop a try late on, and then scored the kind of put the dagger in to finish them off. So I'll go for him. I'd say most of the villains have been on Ireland's side, to be honest.
That was Mick Scully. Before him, Neil Squires, Andy Howell, and our resident expert, World Cup winner and Mirror columnist Paul Grayson. I'm Alex Spink, and this podcast has been The Mirror More. Thank you for your company these past 8 weeks. We will be back this autumn for the Rugby World Cup direct from Japan. Please join us then.